You are very welcome to Cawley's Call with me, Alan Cawley, powered by Benetti Menswear, a topical debate show covering all things Irish football, along with 1v1 interviews with top-class sports stars from a wide range of different sports.
It's me that's putting on the green jersey, me that's going to take flak from people to say, you're not even Irish. I was big enough to say, I'm going to take it.
There's many people I've spoke to, they always say, I used to put money on you scoring the first goal, but I've never seen any of that money, though.
And Andy, he says, I want the performances that I got from you in Scotland with you under 16s, not that rubbish that you gave me over in Oslo.
Hi everyone, and you're very welcome to Series 2, Episode 29 of Cawley's Call, and it's good to have you all back with us for another busy show off the back of what was a brilliant week for Stephen Kenny and his team. Anybody who listens to this regularly knows that we're all for Stephen Kenny and his team. And it was an absolutely brilliant week, and obviously the lads involved as well, scoring 4 goals last night in the game. We're going to get to all that later on. But before we do get to all that, as regularly, that we do have a guest in, but this week we have somebody who we're all familiar with in terms of his playing days and his playing career, and in more recent times people will know him as the PFEI chairman, and we've had many dealings with him over the years as well and helped us out massively as he's helped out all the players in the league. But today he joins us in studio, Mr. Stephen McGuinness.
Cheers, Alan, thanks a lot for the introduction.
Yeah, off the back of, let's just say, a traumatic spell recently in your life, Stephen, that we're going to get into. I'm sure many people have probably read about it in recent weeks because you have opened up about it and there's been stuff in the papers, and you were on radio, an interview a couple of weeks back as well. And as I say, we know he is the tough centre half and stuff like that, and you've had to use all those characteristics, I suppose, in what you've been through in recent times, Stephen.
Yeah, I have, Alan. I suppose for somebody who played obviously in the league for a long time, and I would consider myself an elite athlete, to be hit with what I was hit with, the stereotype of somebody who gets the cancer that I got both in my large intestine and into my stomach would be the 60-year-old male who's a heavy meat eater. The reality on it is that there's people in their 30s and their 40s getting this disease, and it's something that I'm going to be doing a bit of work with a number of other people to promote that testing gets done earlier. You know, I think you have to be over your 60s now to be tested for the cancer that I got, and I think it's something that the age needs to be lowered, whether it's the foods that we eat when we're younger, processed foods, whether it's what diets, whatever it is, the age profile is dropping dramatically. And I suppose the one message I was trying to get out to people was that to not ignore the warning signs, and that's what I did. There was a number of warning signs that I had leading up to the diagnosis, and I just didn't react to them, to be honest, and that comes from maybe a little bit of ignorance from my end, a little bit of that invincible side, a little bit of that, you know, you play sport, you're head of an organisation which looks after elite athletes, and you feel like you're a bit invincible. The reality is none of us are invincible, and I learned the hard way. It could have been a lot easier if I had got the diagnosis a little bit earlier, but
just take us back, Stephen, I suppose, to the diagnosis originally. How long back are we talking here?
Yeah, the diagnosis was February 1st. I had noticed
of this year
I had noticed some changes in relation to my own body, and things I was doing. I was fatigued very quickly when I went to lift anything physical. So if I lifted a radiator, which I was doing, lifted a radiator 10 yards, I had to sit down for a minute or two after it. But yeah, I could paint the whole house. So there was contradictions there that I was using as an excuse. I said, that's just something, don't be worried about that. I played 5-a-side in the FAI and was completely and utterly exhausted after, and I could feel my heart beating really heavy. Again, I just put that down to my age. I put that down to all different types of things. I passed blood one day, which was the real warning. So I should have really reacted to that one, because that was literally the cancer bursting from the large intestine into the stomach, and I should have reacted to that. I didn't. I put it down to a new Texas that me and Stewie would know, it's just open around the corner for me, and I had eaten it the night before, and I put it down to that, which again is a little bit of that sort of bravado. It would be grand. It's just one of them things. It wasn't. It was more than that.
So if the diagnosis was the 1st of February of this year, Stephen,
yeah,
were these things happening pre-Christmas type things?
Yes, yeah. These were going back, Alan, as far as the March previous, you know. So
that long ago, yeah?
That long, okay. Yeah. And it does take time for it to obviously for it to develop within your system. And it was, mine was grade 3, so there's different grades, obviously, of cancer. And the shock to the system was one thing. The one thing I struggled with was the mental side of it. I just really struggled with dealing with what I had got. When I was looking in the mirror, I looked at the guy coming back out at me and calling myself, that's not me. Like, and how can I get this? How considering I don't drink, I don't smoke, and I lived a fairly active lifestyle. How have I got this disease? How has it come on my door? And I was very lucky to have really good infrastructure around me with family and friends and people involved in the game, which were hugely helpful when you were going through the difficult times. But from the operation, which removed three quarters of my stomach and the large intestine, that was on the 15th. I had the operation on the 15th. And then I had self-isolation for about 2 to 3 months where I just didn't want to see anybody. I didn't know what to do.
Before we get to all that, because that's the, I really want to get into that side of things in terms of the mental side, how it affected you. But when, I suppose, these warning signs were happening, Stephen, and some thoughts come into your head about what it might be, what it mightn't be, different things, when you eventually did go to the doctor, how fearful were you of something like being as serious as what it was?
Yeah, I suppose when I had gone to the doctor eventually and got blood tests, I didn't go to see the doctor. I hadn't been to a doctor for 30 years. So when I went in and got the blood tests done, I knew that there was something up. I had get these cold and hot sweats at night, and I knew there was something wrong. I had hoped it was just a blockage. That's what I hoped it would be. But when the doctor had rang back and said to me, look, you need to get into action emergency immediately, your hemoglobin 7.2, the average is between 14 and 17. There's something up in your system. We don't know what it is, but there's definitely something up. So I went in, and the minute I got in the hospital, I had 2 blood transfusions. So that's how bad a state I was in. And when I was lying in the hospital, I sort of realised there's something serious here. And when I went down then for the tests, when I got the tests, I was getting wheeled back up to the room, and I could see the team of people following me, and I knew that wasn't going to be good news. And the more difficult point is you're in COVID. So I'm sitting in a room on my own with no support, a doctor coming in and telling you you've got a disease which many people feel that it's the end of the world. And that was the most difficult to face that on your own with no support around you.
The blood transfusions, Stephen, yeah. Is that because you lost so much blood from when you passed it?
Yeah, there was a loss of blood, Stu, when I passed it, but also there was a lack of, from the blood cell point of view, that my blood wasn't pumping at the rate it needed to be, and they need to get fresher blood into
right.
it. And I noticed straight away, as soon as I got the blood transfusion, that I felt better. You know, I felt more energetic.
Right,
I was completely flat. Like, the body was basically...
Slowing down
to a stage where it was going to keel over, like.
Right, and so I don't mind the passing of the blood thing, right? I wouldn't mind focusing on, because I'm going to be honest, I have things that happen to me, but like, was it very obvious that there was a clear level of blood in your stool, right? You know,
yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you why I'm saying this here. I cycle a lot, okay, so I get irritation in my backside, and you know, sometimes there's a bit of blood there, whatever. But it's obviously because of, you know, I think this is kind of important because people might go, well, God, that happens to me sometimes or whatever. But there was clearly a half a point of blood or something
there was a rush to you, but
okay,
even on that side of
did
it.
Did you tell anyone about that at
no,
the time?
No, kept that to myself.
Not even your wife?
Not even my wife. I completely kept that to myself because it went, Alan, the next day, because what happened is seals immediately. Once it burst through, it seals immediately. So as far as I was concerned, it was just a one-off thing, and I didn't want the diagnosis. I didn't want anybody to tell me there's something wrong with me.
That's amazing that you would see that and you would pass it off as thinking it was
something because it went the next day, so it was gone. It wasn't that I was doing this. If this was happening regularly, right, well then it would have been a different ballgame. But
you mentioned, Stephen, about the whole elite footballers feel like we're invincible, the bravado of men and things like that.
Yeah.
I know it's a lot more prevalent now that people do speak out about mental health and different things. But just in terms of when you did go in, you mentioned there obviously the doctor, and you realised then there's something going on. Were you hit with an unbelievable fright?
Oh, it's the most frightening thing I've ever faced in my life. I knew when he had followed me immediately after I got wheeled out, and I knew it wasn't going to be good news. And the warning signs that there was something really, really amiss was that I wasn't getting any abdominal pain. I was getting no blockages. So that was worrying me. And the more I spoke to doctors for the 2 days that they were doing tests, the more I realised there's something serious here, because you should be seeing signs. There should have been blockages in your stomach, you know? But there wasn't. And the body finds a way of going around things. So as this was growing in through me, I got no abdominal pain. There was nothing to show that this was actually growing inside me. And I then, as the 2 days were going and the hours were going, I was saying, this is going to be bad. This they can't come up with that in here. This is going to be serious. And I just knew how the body felt, and the blood transfusions, everything were pointing towards the worst case scenario, which is what it was like. But through the worst case scenario, it's funny, like the surgeon came in, Jorgen Munslow, and he sat me down and he says to me, hey, Stephen, you have, but he says, I'm going to be able to get this. He said, I'm going to be able to take this out. And he says, just...
That must have been a huge...
relief. And I tell you what, Stu, because he said to me, the next person I'm going into, I can't get it with them. They're going to have to get radiation, going to have to shrunk.
He was that honest.
And that positive.
So, yeah, that positive.
That's what you want to hear,
yeah,
right?
And what he had said, though, was that the stomach, he wouldn't have to take a huge amount away. Unfortunately, when they went in, they had to take a lot more of the stomach than what they had expected. They had to take away 3/4 of it in the end, and in a 9-hour operation. But the peace of mind of him saying, I can get this, was huge. And they gave me 2 weeks then prepare for the operation, so they gave me 2 weeks of work that I had to do to prepare the body for what was coming then with the operation.
Were you kept in hospital for that 2 weeks, Steve?
I was released with a program to work on, which was to strengthen the core, to eat protein, to make sure I was ready for what was coming. I was never ready, by the way, for what did actually come, because there's no way you could prepare.
But can you imagine what it would have been like if you hadn't done the 2 weeks?
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
You,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
you'll never know. Point
of view. Do you mean you weren't ready, both physically and emotionally?
I wasn't nowhere near it, Alan. I just...
When you went home, was it just pure fear for that couple of weeks?
Do you know what? I didn't, because I knew it had to be done. Like, it's mad when you hit that scenario, your body and your head tells you, you've got to get right here. Like,
you're going to survive mode.
Yeah, you do. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. It's survival mode. You're going, I'm going to get through this. And I'd have a lot of positivity around me, and I would be fairly strong enough in my head to say, I'm going to get through this. Like, nothing's going to knock me back. I'm going to be okay here. Mm. Now, I wasn't... When the operation did take place, it was in hospital just over 2 weeks afterwards, and that was a difficult time because nobody can visit it. Mm. You know, so I'm very lucky with the likes of Trevor Crowley, who rang me every single day, and other people who were around me. But that was, the isolation of it was really difficult. I found that really hard to deal
with. Just alone with your thoughts for that.
Only your thoughts, and I was in a room on my own, and in Monica's ward, and the Mater Hospital were incredible, and they were on to me. Actually, just sent me a message yesterday thanking me for mentioning them there, that the staff were so good and so helpful. But it was unbelievably tough, and it's 42 staples, so it's opened up from the chest bone to the top of my groin, and I'd got pneumonia in hospital as well. I had a number of other little side issues that happened while I was there, so it was really tough, and I had to learn to eat again, which was really difficult. So the signals from the stomach to the brain had broken down, so I actually didn't feel hungry. So I'd gone a couple of days without eating anything, and these were stuff I had to train and teach myself to do again, which was really, really, really tough.
You mentioned there the surgeon, Mr. Munslow.
Yes.
So after the operation, and obviously hopefully it all went well and he feels it was a success, does he come in then and tell you we're delighted with it, we're happy, or how was that conversation?
It was interesting, Alan, as well, on that conversation, because these guys are fairly, they're just straight. They don't mess around with words, especially around this type of illness. And it was, he'd come in every day, but I'd got other tests to make sure, because the big thing I was fearing had it spread, like, had it gone into the lymph nodes. And that was the real worry I had. And it was, he came in one day with a team, and there's a team of them, right? So he's the main one, and the team are around them. And he came in and look, how are you feeling? Yes, it was grand. And just as a passway comment, just to let you know, he says, it hasn't spread. It's fine. Now I burst into tears, like, and he just walked straight out the door. And one of the nurses who were a part of his team came back to me and said, look, it's great news, but Dr. Munzo's into the next person who it knows isn't as good. So he's just
work mode.
It's just one of them things. Yeah. And I was that emotional that this hasn't spread. It hasn't gone into lymph nodes. They've got it all. And I'm going to be fine. You'll have to get tested and all the rest. And July and January every year, you'll be tested twice a year for 5 years. And then once a year after that, you'll go and meet the oncology team and you'll work with them. And because I had to go and get chemo then after it. But it was, they're that cold. Like, it's just, that's just,
yeah, that's his day to day stuff.
That's the world he lives in.
Kicking the football or whatever,
exactly. That's him. Yeah. And off he goes. And that was a key point, Stu, I suppose, from my point of view, to get that peace of mind that it hadn't spread, it hadn't gone anywhere else, it was localised, they got it and it's gone.
Looking back, actually, would you be the kind of person that maybe just prefers that the doctor's straight with you?
Yeah, I'm not into that. I wouldn't be into the whole talking about, you know.
Surely in life you want people to be straight with you. As you're mentioning that there, and we're obviously in football, the amount of shy talk with managers and all, just be straight and up front with you and tell you exactly what it is and get on with it.
Yeah, and I suppose sometimes some people need that little bit, you know, more, maybe an arm around them or whatever. I'm just not that type of fella, so I'm different. Just tell me the way it is. Tell me what I've got to do. That's what I want to know. I want to know. After
I think that's his job anyway. He has to be.
Well,
you know,
you'd be amazed at how often you would hear either surgeons or consultants giving diagnoses to people, but they would just give a diagnosis and then that would be it. What sticks in my head about what your doctor told you was, I'm going to fucking get this thing.
Yes.
That's I mean, that must have been incredible. Yeah,
just a relief that it could, that you can actually get this out of me. Now, obviously, there's gonna your body is scarred because you're looking at taking away the large intestine and taking away 3/4 of your stomach. But at that stage, I couldn't care what he took away. Yeah. Once he was taking this out of me, that's the most.
Again, survival mode. Fucking do what you got to do, and then you've got somebody. You're saying, I want that doctor because he's gonna fucking get a hold of this thing, and get it out of me.
And he was just, as you said, he also then put me more. Because sometimes, what was me, he's saying to me, I'm going to the next person and I can't do it.
Yeah,
right. So he said, you just think about that for a minute. He says, so as bad as you think you are, and as bad as, and how long it's going to take you, but take you 6 months to get over this, he says, the next person I'm going to do, I'm not going to be able to say that to him.
It's amazing, that, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's
when you, Stephen, so obviously after going through all this, the operation, you come out the other side, and then there's the recovery period, and this is what they're talking about. But what struck me, even reading the articles last week and listening to you on the radio, it was almost like the worst was about to happen with the mental side of things then, because you really suffered with that side of it.
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting all to suffer with that side of it, because again, back to the three of us played high level football ways, where, you know, you're under extreme pressure and, you know, and get results in football matches and get, you know, do this, do that, do that. And in life, we all make decisions. And I just thought to myself, I'm going to be fine here. Like, this would be grand. I strolled out of the hospital after 2 weeks. Well, I didn't stroll out. I came out 2 weeks and I thought, this would be grand. And next, all of a sudden then, I ended up in a situation where I had lost 35 pounds in weight. I was 11 stone, 11 pounds from 15 stone, just less than 15 stone going in. And I'm looking in the mirror and going, I don't want anybody to see me like this. I when I saw my family's reaction to how I looked, they cared about me. So their reaction to me was they actually cared, but I felt it made me feel terrible that they looked at me, oh my God. And you could see people's reactions.
Yeah.
But in-laws, and I go, oh my God, I must look awful. So I just didn't want. Now, that's my in-laws. The last thing I want to see is players or people I represent seeing me, because you have this thing of where you're running something and you have a feeling of how you should look and how you should feel. And I couldn't believe what I faced in the mirror, and I couldn't believe how weak I was mentally to it. I couldn't pick the phone up. I couldn't answer it. I was exhausted constantly. I couldn't talk to anybody. And I had 2 months of self-isolation where I didn't move. And it took Alan, and I heard just talk about Alan on the podcast a couple of times in regards to how good a player he was. an unbelievably good player, and a great mate of mine from when we were kids. But he has gone through his own struggles, the well documented, and he basically just decided, you know what, I'm going to come over and I'm going to get him.
He actually came over.
He came over.
Well, you grew up with Alan, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
So Alan Moore, by the way.
Alan Moore,
yeah. Yeah, so we had, he lived in Berryfield, I lived in Dunsink, a kick of a ball away, and David Kennedy, another friend of mine, we lived in a triangle. And
in the same class in Patrician as well, college, yeah.
So Alan was actually just a year under me, but we played the same school team together, and he had gone through it, and he knew exactly how I was feeling, and he knew.
And not many, I suppose, do know that, Stephen.
No, unless
you've kind of gone through.
And even though I was the same, Alan, I would look at our players in our league who are getting services. I heard players talking to you today, but thankfully, about how well the services were working for us. And I used to always look and go, how could they have mental health problems? Best young player in the country, he's an underage international, or he's going to be an Irish international, going to England, he's earning all this money. How is he struggling with his mind? How is that an issue? And then when you're in the scenario yourself, you really get to understand it. And Alan done was, he basically came to the house, stood in the garden, and refused to move unless I came out. Because he'd been texting me and ringing me, saying, oh, mommy, I said, don't come near me. I don't talk to anybody that's texting. Don't come near me.
So he was actually standing out in the garden
and just refused to go until I came out. So then I came out, sat down, and I sat in the garden. It was blazing hot day, I remember it well. Him and David, a friend of mine, and he says, he sat down, he just says, right, what's the story? He said, you don't look too bad. And then just that little, you know, just somebody to tell you that it's not as bad as you think it is. Yeah. And then we start chatting about when we were kids, and, you know, him going on trials to England and playing for Ireland and all this type of stuff. And I remember going back into the house, a little pep in my step, going, do you know what? So I'm actually not too bad.
So I'm interested in the psychology of that, because when you said to me, when you saw your family's reaction to how they saw you. No, obviously they're only seeing you for the first time. You're looking at yourself in the mirror every day, and it maybe the impact isn't as extreme as it is for someone who hasn't seen you maybe in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in the psychology of that. Does that give you a kick in the arse, or does it go, do you know what? I'm gonna do something about this. Or did it take Alan maybe to say, I mean, the first thing I said to you when you came in is, "Jeez, you look great."
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You did, and was that the big hell for you, Alan? Just that little bit of confidence, something to grab a hold of,
and say, do you know what, he said, I'm not talking too bad. So then maybe I'll turn the corner here a little bit, because my family saw me every day. The in-laws, my own extended family, everybody see me. And the thing, as you said, Stu, that reaction to how I looked, that shock on people's face, I couldn't handle that.
Were you just hiding away from the world?
Like, absolutely.
When we say, like, as you mentioned here, it was the heat wave or the blazing hot weather, you were shutting the
blinds down, Alan, doors shut, and I lay in a bed with no TV on, nothing. And I tell you how I lived. I lived from sleeping tablet to sleeping tablet. All I wanted to do was get through the day and get on the next sleeping tablet. That was all I wanted to do. So I was taking sleeping tablets. I thankfully I've come off them actually in the last 2 weeks because they make you quite drowsy the next day. So my only the things that were going on in my head is, this what I'm going to be left like? Is this life now for me? Am I going to have to deal with this for the rest of my life?
Yeah.
And that was my worry. And then when you start meeting people, like I met with Alan, who had gone through similar to me, not from an operational point of view, but from a mental point of view, that no, things will get better. It will turn for you. And there was work done by ARC at Mater Hospital, who are brilliant in telling you that your body's gone through a trauma. It's like a car crash it's had. Yeah. So it's sending different signals, and it takes time for it to heal and to repair. But again, me, I don't have time to wait. I want to be better now. Like, and the reality is, it's not like that. And when Alan left, and I went back up to the room, I remember saying to myself, maybe, and I was looking at myself slightly differently, which is mad. Like, I looked in the mirror and looked at myself slightly differently.
Psychology had changed almost.
Because somebody had told me.
See, in terms of Stephen, that period, say, and obviously we're focusing solely on you, and rightly so, in terms of what you've gone through.
Mm.
But say then, when you come out of the hospital and your family support network, and they see you in that situation as well, it must be very scary. You're close to your boy, obviously.
Yeah.
He's down at the match as well. Like, so they must have been quite scared and get a fright to see their dad in that situation and position as well.
Yeah, especially when I was coaching this team, and again, me and him would go everywhere, like everybody and all your kids. They were good, actually. I didn't tell them initially exactly the extent of it, right? And it's interesting now, he'd say to me, I saw you on Things Your Day. Jeez, I didn't realise it was as bad as that. I didn't let him know it was bad. He used to go down to the Bows games when I wasn't there, right? So we'd go down to matches because he's part of the supporters group. So he did the flags up, and people would be asking him, how was your dad? He's grand, like, because he didn't know the full extent. And I tried to keep it away from them as best as I possibly could, because I don't need them worrying about something that I needed to fight. I needed to battle it. And the other thing in the hospital, they kept saying to me, is, do you have a family? I think when you've got something to hold on to, you fight that bit harder, you know? Mm. You got kids, I did notice that they kept saying that to me, do you have family? And do you have? And it just gives you something to grab onto.
It's an interesting angle and question to be keeping.
It is.
Just without saying it straight out, they're just putting thoughts in your
head that you have to
fight for them. Yeah.
But obviously your family are there, like, I mean, they care for you. They know there's something wrong, okay, but and they're just there to kind of be there for you, look after you. What's going on in your head? Are you trying to say, you know, I still want to be strong for them, or are you just trying to push through are you literally just taking it day by day, hour by hour?
I got a great bit of advice too from one of the doctors, because in my head, right, I'm thinking about a month down the line, I'm thinking about my job, how am I going to keep the job going?
Okay.
How does the union keep working? Like, how do I do the accounts are coming up, how am I going to do the accounts, how is Ollie and Simone going to work without me? And I'm thinking about months down the line, and the doc said to me, think about the next 40 minutes.
Right.
That was the best bit of voice I got. Okay. Think about the next 40 minutes. Think about what you're going to do next. Don't worry about 4 months away.
Yeah.
Just think about the next 40 minutes. What are you going to do in the next 40 minutes? What are you going to do in the next hour? And mind yourself. Don't be worrying. Everybody, life goes on. And look, the testament to that is, the union went on, by the way, without me. And life goes on without, and we all worry about, gee, what'll happen? No, things go on, and people, like, I think the strength of the association was the fact that nobody even knew I was missing. Like, and that was fair play to Ollie and Simone who went and ran things. But I needed to focus on the next hour, not about months away, which is what I was thinking about. I need to think about the next hour. And as time went on, Stu, in my own head, I managed to grasp where I was. I managed to grasp the position I was in, that it was going to take time to heal. But I was seeing incremental. I was getting better. I was getting a little bit better. I was able to hold the phone for a little bit longer. I was able to hold conversations with people that little bit longer.
You could see differences and all that.
I could see myself walking a bit further. So every day I'd try and get up in the morning. After it's broken down, he said to me, go on, just walk, will you? A bit of fresh air. Once the air goes into your lungs, you just feel better. So I started then to do little walks. Started off at maybe 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then build it up. And it was these little incremental things. And then the weight started to, then suddenly then I just noticed, you know, I used to weigh myself every day. This is another thing I shouldn't have been doing, by the way.
Right.
I just weigh myself every single day. So I suddenly got into 12 stone. Gee, that's good, isn't it? Yeah, getting into 12 stone. Then I was starting to put an app on the phone, so I was eating every hour. So I was gradually, little things were starting to fall into place. And as time was going on, I had to go on a course of antidepressants. They took about a month to kick in. And once they started to balance me up, I felt hell of a lot better. And then we're back to, thankfully, today wearing 14 stone 6 pounds, which again shouldn't be weighing myself. Wow. I'd be the boy I am, 14 stone 6 pounds today.
You're going to go back playing now as well, are you?
Yeah, well, we were at the FAI last night.
The boots were clean and everything.
I was at the game last night, and the lads are funny, like the young lads that are involved in the FAI, you all play five aside. Like, and one of the lads said, I was reading a piece of you today, and he said, I read that you weren't well. He said, you weren't well the last five aside we played, he said, you just smashed straight into me. So,
just on Morsey there, and obviously, yeah, like we all played, as you say, different levels and the highest level, whatever the case may be. But for the likes of, isn't sport unbelievable? Like we you think at a good times and scoring goals and moments where you won things or different things like that. But the people you meet along the way and who become friends, and it's only at times like this that you realise who your pals are, who your friends are, stuff like that. Yeah. Like for him to travel over from England, stand outside the door and say, I'm not moving until you come out and talk to me.
Yeah.
Like that's, to me, that's unbelievable. That's a real friend.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was with him at the 21s game the other day, the Irish under 21 match the other day, and he just doesn't see it that way. You know, he just sees that something that.
I know that's his character. Like, that's, but for us to say it, like we obviously know Morsy well, but I think that when I heard that the other day, I thought fair play to him.
Yeah, no, it is, and as I said, I'd be forever grateful to him. But it's just something, I suppose.
The conversation, Stephen, to me, what's interesting to me is the fact that it's not like he's coming over giving you a team talk. No. It's just the fact that he's there. He's there for you. Yeah. You acknowledge he's outside for me.
I agree with you. And I think football, we have a brilliant community in football. And it's only when you're hitting the situations that I was in, do you realise how big the community is, how much people actually care about you. Look, I had massive rows with people in the FAI. And I mean huge rows.
We know about them.
Yeah. And they even they reached out. Barrett, the only one actually didn't text me was John Delaney. Everybody else did. But a huge amount of people reach out. And probably we all don't know how we affect people's lives every day by what we do. So you probably don't know how many people you affect by this, by the calls that you do, by the podcast, or Stewie's opinion on things. But it does, like, and people do care. And I learned a hell of a lot about people and the real people in my life that are important to me. And they stood up. And the likes of Trevor Colley, can't thank Trevor enough. Absolutely superb. Like,
can I ask you, like, you decided to do this, right? Is it helping you cope with the process?
Yeah.
And is it also, is there part of you that wants to get this information out to somebody? Because if one person is listening to this, and they might go, I think I might go to the doctor off the back of that. Does that help you? Or what's going on in your head?
It's a good question, Stu. I tell you what the reason I did it was because I was starting to go to matches, right? And I was meeting people. So I was at the Bowes Cup game against Maynooth, and I met Martin Russell, former teammate of mine, manager in the league, and yapping away to him, he knew nothing, right? So it goes off.
I didn't know.
I only found it last week. That's the guy's honest truth.
And we're living around the corner from each other. But it was getting awkward for me, to be honest. So lads are ringing me up saying, I was only talking to you today. You never said it to me. I felt like a right bollocks for not knowing. Yeah. I decided I'm going to do something. Now, I did think about it quite a bit, to be honest. I didn't just rush into it. I had a good think about it. I wanted it not to be about me. It's not about me. As you said, Sue, can I do something here that can assist people? That somebody listens to it and says, you know what? That sounds like what the situation that actually I'm in. Or that, the mental side of illness is not talked about. It's the physical side. So everybody asks me, well, how do the stitches heal? How's your stomach? How are you eating? All this. But it was the mental which was more difficult. Mm. So that was what I decided, that when I was going to do it, and I spoke to Mark McCadden at the Star, and I said, this is the way I wanted to do it. And he said, absolutely. And I think, Stu, what I've got from it is a huge amount of... I've got a lot more over than I thought. I just thought, just get it out there. And
have you been surprised by the reaction?
Unbelievable. I've never. It's in the thousands of people that have been in touch, and I've had people in touch with me now to talk that they're in the same situation as I was in, and could I help them? Now, I'm not a psychotherapist, so I'm not trying to, but I can give them
But absolutely, you're now in a position of influence and experience, I mean, your head must be going around in circles now. Yeah. What you can do with this, right?
And I realise, Joe, as well, that I have a platform that others don't have.
Absolutely.
So I had a girl on the other day to me who's 36 years of age, stage 4 cancer, who has a degree in nutrition, who had gone to Bali to learn yoga, who had done all this stuff, and she's 36 years of age with stage 4 cancer. Like, how is that? She's a nutritionist, so everything going into her body, she knew what she was doing. So this disease isn't something that's, that is, that I said to you earlier, that stereotypical 60-year-old heavy eating alcohol. So I do have a platform and I realise that, and I have to use that for as good, in as much good as I can, and that's why I'm going to get involved in a campaign to see can we get the age down in regards to getting tested for this, because blood tests won't show this. They have to be scanned.
So that's interesting. It's a particular scan that will actually pick it up.
That will pick it up, exactly.
When was the last time you were blood tested?
About 2 years ago, and I'm going to be going back to Allenbourne I had it in my head to go back a couple of weeks ago. I have to be honest, COVID puts me off, but when I read your story, I said I'm fucking definitely going back to get it. I'm gonna get an MOT done. Like,
a mate of mine went through something similar with you, Stephen, and that's why I have a little bit, I wouldn't say knowledge, I've listened to his experience, and a friend of mine that's been through the wars as well, but he, ever since, he's always saying to me, "Now get your bloods done, get your bloods done." And it was only recently I went and did it, and thankfully everything came back good. But one thing that came back was, because I was feeling a bit fatigued and running down, and you're putting it down, I just run down, I'm doing too much, I'm going here or whatever.
Yeah.
Went, and it was basically your B12 was just, that was what the doctor said. He said that's easy fix. You get a tablet or you get injections just to improve it, but everything else is fine. But for people listening, it's so important, as you said, and I know the mental health stuff and the conversations, it's getting better and people speak now and all that, but there is still that element, I feel, of men being like, I'll be crap, park it there. And
definitely men. Alan, I think, like, my wife would go on a whim, and anything, she would be tested. She would, and she works for a doctor, so she's aware of and alert to it. And with my kids, she'd be gone with them straight away. But me, completely different ballgame. And it's a male thing. We don't even talk about it. Like, we don't talk to each other about how we feel. We don't talk to each other about it, like what Stewie said. Surely that's a sign if you pass blood. Yes, it is. But if I had said that to somebody, like, if I just chatted to Stewie, met him in Tesco's, I'd have said, "Geez, that happened to me, Stewie." He'd have said to me, "Get yourself to the freaking doctor." And I probably would have.
That astounds me. Of all the stuff you've told us, the fact that you passed so much and you just hit it all away.
Yeah, and the reason was, Alan, because the next day it was gone. If it had been constant, I would have. But it was gone the next day, and I just put down to
a one-off thing.
It's one-off. It's no big deal.
And can you remember what you ordered in the chicken plate? Was it a Zinger burger or something? Was it?
So come here, Stephen. You're obviously in very good form now. A long road to recovery, I'm sure, but you're in good spirits, and you mentioned there the weight back up and all.
Yeah.
Are you back to work?
Yeah, back to work, yeah. Okay. So things haven't changed. The league's
any arguments with anyone?
No. the league's probably in a healthier spot, to be honest.
Does this help, by the way? Do you like people kind of maybe talking to you and laughing about it as well? Is it usually important?
Definitely,
you mean?
Yeah. No, you course, can't, right? It can't be gloom and doom forever. And as I said, I'm getting a huge amount of people contacting me to ask for a bit of advice. And I now plan my day, you know. So now I have stuff going on all the time.
Like, right.
You know, so I think about what I'm going to do in the next hour, the next 2 hours. So it just getting back to work and getting back to doing what I enjoy doing. The big issue is not being in dressing rooms, I have to say. That's the most difficult. So you're ringing lads to try and find out what the lie of the land is, what the challenges that, let's say, a Finn Harps player has to a Shamrock Rovers player. You know, look, I met with the Finn Harps lads actually the other day. Their issue was they had no showers, like, so they're having to travel all this distance. We're dealing with the FAA around it. Can we start, you know, sorting out, surely with the way we are with COVID now, the showers can be had for players. So it is, but from my end, from a mental point of view, it's just great to be back. It's great to be back in work. It's great to be talking to people again. It's great to be talking about what we all enjoy, which is the game, which is the most important.
Absolutely. And I suppose, Stephen, with the fact that you're back now, I know we've gone through the COVID stuff and all, the league went quite well in terms of the half league and all that kind of stuff, and we got through it.
Yeah.
And now we're back up and running with a full league. Hopefully, slowly but surely, attendances are picking up and we might get back to a stage where even more can get in.
Yeah.
Where, I know it's probably might be a difficult question for you to ask at the moment because you've been out of it for that period of time.
Yeah.
But where is the league right now, would you feel, kind of the bigger picture where we're at?
Yeah, first of all, financially, it's in really good shape. This could be the very first year that we haven't had any financial problems, which is really positive, considering what the country is going to. Yeah, well, as the two of you as well know, having dealt with both is on financial issues during your careers, that's a real positive. So it probably shows that the clubs are a lot more. Weather worn is the right word, but they're a lot more weathered in regards to how they do their business. And I do find that the models, from a financial point of view, when I'm only dealing with players' wages, is what I look at. And we're in a situation where we're going to end the season where everything's grand. There's no financial issues at all, which is superb. And so that gives us a good platform to move forward. I do think the sound bites out of the FAI are better. I think that the people who are involved now, there's an energy about the organisation that wasn't there before, I have to say. I'm not saying that the people that weren't there before weren't good, but they were more better administrators. I think there's a bit of an energy around, there's a younger cohort around now. I've obviously spoken to Jonathan Hill and Roy Barrett over recent days and weeks, and there definitely looks like there's a more they want a more input from everybody. So we have a strategic meeting with all the delegates at each club, our delegates at each club next Thursday week, to look at the strategic plan the FA have and get input from the players. Now that's something that we've never had, and one of the biggest issues I have is that there's no platform for players, there's no platform to improve things, so to make the league more professional. And I was glad to hear Jonathan Hill speaking recently about the league being more professional. We need the league to be more professional, because ultimately, as we saw last night, I mean, the next group of players are going to be coming from our league, you know?
Absolutely.
And that's why our league has never been as important as it is right now, and that's why it needs the investment. And I've listened to your show a number of times, and there's loads of different ideas of, you know, we need to have the grounds better, of course we do, we need to have, you know, youth development coaches at every club, or academy coaches at every club, of course we do. But what we needed is all of us on the one page, or we all need to have an input into how that goes. Before, it was the clubs deciding where we were going, and that was it, and nobody had an input. I definitely see that opening up, and as I said, we meet Thursday week with the FAI, we meet tomorrow with the FAI in regards to the fixtures for next season, where we hope that will be positive changes there.
Government input. How do you, huge, right? Is it everything, or do we need it?
Do you know what, Stu? In my opinion, is the most important thing.
But you mentioned there, Stephen, sorry for jumping in, but you mentioned there about the fact that you feel there's a better appetite about the new look FEI as such. We've gone through the years where you're dealing with the FEI and there's no one even talking to you in the offices, like bonkers stuff. Whereas now there's that energy about the younger generation, people coming in, Jonathan Hill and new regime, whatever phrase you want to put on it. But do you feel that if the government funding is going to come, they're actually viewing the FEI in a much kind of more attractive way than what they'd seen it before?
I can't overstate this, but when you see the likes of Robert Waugh, who was talking the last night of the game, he's involved with the FAI. From a governance point of view, they're proper people who understand how business should run. Roy Barrett is top class in what he did from a stock exchange point, or stockbroker's point of view. Like, there's really good people involved. Packy's obviously back involved, he's going to chair the international committee, which we have a position on. There's a slight weakness for me, is that there's not enough player representation through the spine of the FAI. I still think we're on one committee, so we've only got one voice. I'm trying to work with Jonathan Hill in regards to looking at a player status committee where we can get men and women's players, that the issues that they have are brought to the table and discussed. So that's something that we're working on with Jonathan. But there's definitely people there that you look at it, and if I was the government, you'd be looking at a hell of a lot more credible than it was in the past, that there's proper people there. So if you are going to put your money, it's going to be invested in the right way, and that it's going to go into the infrastructure of the game, not into back people's pockets or into friends or mates or whatever had gone on before. It definitely looks, and it needed to be ripped apart and restarted, and it's taken a long time, right? This isn't something that was going to happen overnight, and it's going to take another little period of time. But the people I see involved, I would be confident that it's a far better ship than it was before.
It feels that way to us as well, doesn't it, Stu? Like, I genuinely, we're at games every week, we obviously discuss different things every week. I genuinely feel that's the case outside. It's taken time, as you said, it'll take even more time, but I definitely feel as though, even if you're viewing Stephen and what's going on in terms of the international team, and for that to filter down, all of a sudden the League of Ireland is in the conversation.
It
was never in the conversation when you talked about the Irish team. It was World Cups, European Championships, whatever. We were never in that conversation, whereas now people actually genuinely acknowledge that Jamie McGrath's come through here. James McLean has come through here. They've come through our league. Young fellas now, Gavin Bazuna, that might have been with an underage team, or Shamrock Rovers, whoever, with the underage structures, and then gone on whatever. Like, they actually acknowledge where these boys have started off from.
I think there was for a long time a detachment in the FAI between the international team, which was a separate, it looked like it was just running on its own, and it was completely separate to anything that we were doing here. I think Stephen in charge, it has definitely become closer. Like, it's the first time we've heard a manager's name being chanted at a game last night. There's only one Stephen Kenny, and that the cohort of supporters, I'd say, in the stand there are people with a League of Ireland background, and understand what he's done and what he's, you know, what he's trying to do. And I definitely feel there's a closer connection, even in the little things. So there's a couple of promotions that the FAI have going on. They're working with Bank of Ireland, they're working with all the different sponsors, and there's a feeling that we're all part of that sponsorship. Where before there was no chance, they had a sponsorship deal off, they went and done it, but they're engaging with us now, and not just us, with other stakeholders as well. And that's why what's happening Thursday week is the first time it's ever happened that the FAI have come and asked the delegates. So we have a delegate at every single club, and that we're all going to sit around the table and talk about how the game is being brought forward, what the FAI's ideas are, and asking the players what their ideas are. Like, that is a massive step forward from where we were before. And you get a credit to the likes of Mark Scanlon, who's only new in, who doesn't carry any baggage, and he's coming in with his own plans, and it's stuff I know we were talking about earlier, and we probably get into it now, of where the league is going to go, and some of the stuff that's been holding the league back, in my opinion, for too long, and we're starting to see maybe them barriers coming down, which would be great.
Well, give us what are those things?
I suppose the one thing that I always felt was the season was too short, way too short.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement.
Yeah, we're all in agreement with that. So we expect now, again, it has to be announced, but that for the first time that we will have international breaks for the first time we'll be in our league. So instead of us having situations as we were chatting about earlier, where matches had to be called off, or one game was off, and another game maybe off, or they only get two called in, or one called in into international under 21s or senior squad, that we're in a situation now where hopefully from next season. And this is the discussion that we're having with the FAI, and we do expect this to be in that the international breaks will be in our league for the very first time. So when there's an international break, there'll be no league fixtures.
Okay.
So there's no clashes anymore.
To me, that makes total sense, Stephen.
It does, yeah.
Because say, for example, the example I would use is Bowes this year have Dawson Devoy, Ross Tierney, and Andy Lyons called up for every international fixture, and Bowes have a game called off.
Yeah.
That's not fair on anyone, really.
No, it's not.
You know, the club that they're due to face, the three lads miss that, you know, that are away with the team. So, and I always found this was the gripe when the mid season break came in first, and Ireland were in the Euros, and it was the right thing to do. What was the point in us playing games when they're in the Euros? But then it carried on, and I never understood why this. I always felt the mid-season break was a waste of time because fellas just wanted to piss off wherever they went. And I know people are saying, oh, well, me family and we want to go. But we're either going to be professional about things or we're not. Yeah. Who else has a mid-season break for fellas to piss off? So you're basically saying now, if that mid-season break is gone, we will just have a break around the time when there's an Ireland international.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the plan. Again, I just have to work it out as well. We were talking about under-21 players maybe not getting a break. But you're looking at this season probably starting now in early February, which is great. Now look, there's little nuances to this, which is lads will probably doing pre-season at Christmas, but so be it. And
I think if you were to speak to all the lads, they'd want to be playing from February to November.
Yeah, but such is the professionalism of players now. And to be quite honest, I remember myself, I'd have a light Christmas dinner, and I'd be off in the gym.
That's just me.
Didn't do it, Alan. But like,
I had two turkeys.
But we would have league fixtures.
Player than you were, you know.
But we would have league fixtures.
We've spoken before.
You played on Christmas Day or Stephen's Day.
Stephen's Day. Yeah.
We've spoken before about the professionalism of young lads now. Like, I mean, these guys are machines nearly, aren't they?
I know a lot of players now, a lot of the younger lads who wouldn't drink from the start of the season. Like, the alcohol is not something that they've been brought up with. Like, it was a culture when we played. The culture's completely gone, and they want to look the best they can look. They want to look better than their teammate. They want to, and there's
the Ronaldo factor.
Yeah, like, I mean, you see the physiques of the players now. Like,
how long are you there now, Stephen, as the chairman?
I'm there now
47 years.
No, actually, you were at the meeting that when I took over.
Yeah.
Me and you were there.
I backed you.
Yeah, you did, actually. You did. You could. Hey, by the way, you could have been me.
And I sent you one of the texts here. I'm including that group. That 15,000 that texted you, I was one of them.
Because I remember Frank Gavin stepping down that day, and me and you and the rest of the committee there, and Frank going, look, I'm going to go to the league. And we were looking at each other going, well, what's going to happen here? And I said, look, I'll take it for it. I was only going to take it for a couple of weeks, actually. Yeah. I said, look, I'll take this for a couple
of
weeks.
The reason I asked you is because.
What were you fucking doing on the board of the PA?
Fran got me involved then after Fran, well, he didn't. He helped me out, and then he fucking, I don't know where he went.
He brought you in so he could bully you, probably.
But the reason I asked that, Stephen, is because the landscape has changed in terms of the league as well. So when we played, or say when I was young and signed for Shells, and we mentioned this a couple of times, and I went into a dressing room for the first time with older senior pros, and I was younger, whereas I'm at matches every week now, and it's all young fellas.
Yes.
Like, it's so young now.
Yeah.
So in terms of you viewing it as representing, say, what the old guard used to be, and I'm not going back 20, 30, I'm talking about, say, 10 years ago, whereas you look at the league now with all young fellas, I feel there's so many opportunities for the young lads there now. Yeah. It's incredible.
And I think the one thing we have to, and you're 100% right on the age profile, we're looking at the average age being 24, like, it's one of the youngest leagues in Europe. And one of the things that we've been working on, we have had a full-time person in, and we're going to have to hire another one on the education side of things, because we need to, they're not earning enough money, right, to be that full time professional. But what we can sell them is something where you can be on good money, but you can also build a career to the side of it, and that's something vitally important. And we put a huge amount of time and resources into it, and we're starting to see the fruition of it. You had Georgie Kelly on recently, yeah. And you see his educational background. Mm-hmm. Brendan Clark has gone back to college now. Like, it's great.
Georgie's
to see
on the verge of doing a master's now.
Yeah.
He was telling us.
Yeah, I was with him yesterday.
While he's banging in goals left, right, and centre.
Yeah, and that's the model that we've got, mm-hmm. And we have to sell that model. Our lads are not going to earn 3 and 4 and 5 grand a week, but what they can do is have a professional career playing a sport they love and be educated in parallel with it. And that's key, I think, for the future of the league. And that's stuff that the FAI are working with us on. And again, we start to see a few green shoots there where they're starting to get interested on that side of things.
In terms of sponsorship as well, I mean, it just got me thinking. I mean, surely there are sponsors, big high profile sponsors out there that would love to get involved with a league that has players like this that yep. want to match professionalism, their mm. athleticism, physical conditioning with educating themselves as well. Like, you know, yeah.
And that's where Bank of Ireland
is. It's a win-win, right?
I know Bank of Ireland are one of the sponsors that the FAI are talking to, and I spoke to them actually just last night at the game, and they're the types of companies now that are looking at the league and going, this league is going, like, we're starting to see the Jamie McGrath coming in, yeah. Like, we're starting to see, you look at Ross Tierney, Dawson Devoy, Kenny at Sligo, looking at top young players mm. coming through here, and it's becoming more attractive all the time. I think the women's game is important as well. I have to say that.
I was just about to say, Stephen, in terms of the development of the women's game as well.
There's a long way to go on that. And we've met with delegates at the clubs as well, and we're chatting to them at the moment in regards to how we bring the women's game forward in parallel with the men's. Because I think any sponsorship deals, as Stewie's saying, in the future have to go hand in hand. Because you can see the Sky Sports deal with the women's senior international team, and that move, which was a really positive one. You see Evoke involved with the cup as well. So if we're going to sell the brand, it needs to go together, I think, going forward. You know, both need to be, if you're selling it to a big blue chip company, if you have women's football at an elite level and men's football at an elite level, it's a bigger sell.
Yeah, I mean, the women's game, from what I can see, is going to explode. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I'm watching an underage game, Stu. I was watching Belvedere's under 10s, and the Morphys, Anthony Murphy and Lee Murphy, one of their, I think it's our niece, was playing. She was unbelievable. Like, yeah. I mean, unbelievable.
Like, shocked the Murphys have another family member that's going to come.
And I'm going to forecast this one. If she's as good. If she's as good, she looks better. Technically better than the lads. Just really, really good. And the women's game, as we said already, is going on. I think the equal pay thing was a good move. People are questioning whether it's a PR move or whatever the case may be, but it doesn't matter. It's positive step. And if you're again a sponsor looking from the outside in, you're saying that's exactly the type of moves. And from Jonathan Hill's point of view,
Stephen? So say before, you mentioned how for the first time in years or ever that there'd be no financial disputes as such, hopefully with players' wage and stuff like that. Are you finding now more and more your time is maybe spent on the women's issues?
Yeah, well we have Simone has been looking after on the women's side of the game. I'm involved from a FIFA point of view, the World Players Union. I'm on the women's committee. I represent the women's national team in Northern Ireland as well, so we've done their collective bargaining agreements, and we obviously do work with the senior women's international team down here as well. And we have delegates now we correlated a lot of the issues that they faced last year, the women's game, put it to the FAI. There's licensing coming in now for the women's game, which is a huge step forward. Mm-hmm. Like, there was issues with the women's game around footballs and around all basic stuff, and I do get the appetite from the FAI. They want the women's game better, so we are putting our feet into different pods now, and our own game is settling down to a certain extent. We still have obviously issues, but not at the level that they were before, and it allows us to spend time on mental health. Like, I was at a workshop this morning around racism, and for the first time in a good few years, I've been able to get my head above the parapet and go, okay, what's the lie of the land now. Like, the next piece for us, Alan, will be for us to start talking to the under 19 squads, because what we're finding now is younger lads are getting in now and they're signing their first contract a bit blindly. So we need to probably get in at 19s and 17s level, get into the dressing room and start educating the guys about being professional players and what's involved in being a professional footballer. So that's the work I see us over the next 2 to 3 years, that we'll drop down the age gaps and start filling in the holes there with 17s and 19s, making sure that they're prepared for when they come into the professional game. This is what's coming.
You mentioned something there as well, I'm glad, and I wanted to ask you the question in terms of a player welfare type thing. So the changes that are coming in next year in terms of, which I think are brilliant, for if the league starts in February, is that definite, more or less?
Yeah, I'd expect that to be the situation.
So if that kicks in for next year, and a few people have said this to me, and I've kind of watched from the outside as well, Stephen. So the under 19s, and then you get the jump to the first team.
Yes.
But there's nothing in between.
Yes.
Are we losing players in that window who were maybe not deemed good enough for a first team?
Yeah, I suppose the argument on this is, two arguments at the same. The argument on this is, if you're not in or around the first team by the time you're 19, right, majority of players, now I'm talking about 99% of players are in or around the first team at that age. I have to give great credit to the Leinster Senior League and how good that league is. Mm. That a lot of the younger players are dropping down to that. But that standard has really risen now, I have to say. I've been at a number of the Moctis games this year,
yeah,
and the standard is really good. Mm. So they're not lost anymore. And the coaches that are there are connected back to the league. So it's not as if they're forgotten. But so, for example, Crowe's at Moctis. We could nearly go around the ball. Yeah. And there's I understand the argument. It's just, from a financial point of view, does it make sense to have a reserve league again? I don't know. And my answer to that would be, I would like to see, and this is the conversation probably going to happen in the next period of time with Packy from a high performance point of view, do we allow two or three players at the 19s level up to a certain age?
That's what I was, because I was, I think when you said there's two sides of it, I'm not only looking at it maybe from an under 19 point of view that the lads are being, I'm talking about if you have a squad of 23 and 24 like we have now, so say you're Shamrock Rovers, Dundalk, whatever, all the clubs have big squads, and you're a lad who's not featuring every week, he's not getting any football either. So I'm not, he could be a 27 year old Alan Cawley and he's not playing in the first team. Shit, what am I going to do for four or five weeks? That can be a tricky one as well.
And I do think there is some scope, and again, what you don't want is a 17-year-old playing against an adult. You know, that has to be looked at as well. But I definitely think that there's a discussion to be had about that player who isn't playing regularly. Can he fit in? But up to a certain age.
Because we used to have the overage thing, didn't we, where you could play two or three.
Did, yeah. But again, we don't want to block it up either by allowing. We need to get the younger players playing as well regularly. And it's an argument, and it's a tricky one.
I mean, exactly. It's a bigger fish to fry, right? Surely, I mean, there are bigger issues that we really need to put our focus on, and that would be on. I mean, what comes to mind would be stadiums, and what's the overall long term plan for that? Like, you know, can we get government intervention? Can we get government funding?
Yeah.
The FAI are obviously key to that, and how they lobby the government.
Yeah.
I know I touched on it probably shortly about the interest from government, which was there. It's still there, right? Or is it, you know, I mean...
Still there.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, like, you see Jack Chambers at games now. I saw him, he was sitting in front of me at the under-21 game the other day. Like, before, we wouldn't have anybody attending. And they're talking about the game.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking about it. But I really need to reinstate this. The women's side of it is important. You know,
surely it's hand in hand, right? It's the men's game. And, like, I mean, Shelbourne, women's and men playing the same stadium.
Well,
not every team. I know Bowes might be a little bit different, but they should all be playing on the same ground.
Yeah. Well,
Sligo are bringing in a new women's team next year.
Yeah, and some of the bigger clubs, to compete in the women's game, you are going to have to be affiliated. So Treaty went the opposite way, which was great. So Treaty had a women's team and then had a men's team. So it doesn't mean that you have to have, it has to be a men's team. Yeah. It has to come into women's. So if P-Mount, for example, had a men's team, that's fine. But as you said, it needs to be hand in hand for the bigger stuff. When we're going to government, Stu, we have to be going to government saying, look at the package we have from grassroots right down. Men's and women's is equal all the way up. And that's where we will get the assistance from government. We haven't been able to prove that, should we, for so long. We haven't been able to prove that we could run our own business right, let alone, you know, both sides of the country. We haven't. And I just think the people that the FAI have got on the board, Stu, it just looks better.
I suppose where I'm coming from is that it's been 2.5 years since Delaney has been moved aside. Is it 2.5 years? Remind me.
It's roughly.
So you feel that it's a long time, you know, and we were at a stage where I know with Kieran Lucas and Niall Quinn and so on and so forth, there was interest there. With Shane Ross was getting involved, so on and so forth. It was great to see. It's all gone a little bit quiet, but I suppose people would love to hear, is there still sort of rumblings in the background? I mean, if there is, I think it would kind of reassure
actually,
people.
To be fair to him, like, and I would stick up for lads, even what Stephen said, there's a lot going on in the back.
Yeah.
Just because they're not shouting about it doesn't mean nothing's going on.
Yeah, but still.
For too long, people were shouting bullshit about it.
But I don't want to turn around in 5 years' time and go, oh yeah, there's talk going on in the background, because it's very important. But you don't know for sure. That's why I'm asking the question.
I know there's plenty going on. I know from speaking to people there's plenty going on.
But no.
We've even seen evidence of it, I think, in terms of what's happening. Even just the appetite alone for people to want to make change and to actually acknowledge that the league has a place now, a very important place.
Totally get it, like, you know, but this is Ireland, you know, things take time. But things stick in people's head, tribunals, all this kind of stuff. Things can move very, very slowly when it comes to this kind of thing, like, you know.
Yep.
And when it goes quiet, I suppose what happens is people think, it's fucking, you know, the same old, you know, nothing's going to come of it, all that kind of thing. All I'm saying is it's important that people get the message, do you know what, we're still here, we're working on it.
Yeah.
It's something that we're focusing on. And I do, I mean, I only had to look at it. There was a dial session going on last week. It was revolving around the Talca Park sale and so on and so forth. Minister for Sport stood up and did speak about government is keeping their eye on this. They're very much interested in the game. Mm. But it's difficult to see that stuff. Like, you know, it's not always there in your face. And you worry, you know, the other sports, rugby, Gaelic, you know, they've got
their
house in
order. Yeah,
but
the one thing I used to always compare when we'd be, say, critical of Delaney or the old regime, I used to always make the comparison of Philip Brown.
Yeah.
Nobody knew who he was. He was in the background, but there was all sorts going on. Just because they're quiet, to me, doesn't mean that there's not an awful lot. I would nearly prefer that, Stu, than them coming out shouting about rubbish when nothing happening, bluster.
Our problem before was that we close off the government because the hierarchy within the FAI didn't want the government to see what they were doing.
For obvious reasons.
In a situation where the curtains are back and they're saying, come in now, have a look what we're doing. We're still the biggest participated sport in the country. From an obesity point of view, from all them other angles, we are the number one sport, right, to assist the nation going forward. It's the one sport that unites everybody.
I walked down through the ground last night, right? So we were in at the match last night and I went up to Baggot Street before the match and I was walking back down and I just looked around at the buzz in the crowd and I'm saying to myself, this is supposed to be a manager who people are suggesting is under pressure. They don't like what's seeing the result. So the place was hopping with young kids and families and people want to get behind this. Like there is stuff happening here.
There's a vibrance around it because of the youth that's in it. So when you're giving young people an opportunity to play like Bazuna, suddenly kids are looking going, that could be me. Like, I'm not far away from
it. I totally agree with all of that. Absolutely. And I can't disagree with anything you've just said. What worries me is that I know there's a cohort of people out there, League of Ireland people, all they fucking want to do is put the game down here and say, it was, this and that. And, I'd love to shut them fucking up. To be quite honest with you,
I think they're.
And I think it's hugely. I think it's hugely important, right? But we have an awful habit of kicking ourselves in the face in the game here, okay? Mm. And there are people that are so ambitious for the game here, but you always feel that you're going up against a brick wall. But I think it's hugely important for the FAI. I know Jonathan Hill is only in the seat for a relatively short period of time, but communication is big, and I think you need to be a little bit more out in front saying this is what's going on. You know, communication is huge, absolutely huge, because like look what's happened during COVID. You know, people get their information from fucking everywhere and anywhere, and we've such a fractured society now, okay? And it's the exact same in the game of football. And in order for the game of football to progress and get to where we want it to get, people have to get on board and they have to buy into it. And there's a huge, I personally think COVID hasn't helped. I don't think it hasn't helped how people's mindset are, because I mean you see where people's heads have gone. Like, you know, they've gone into, some people I think we've lost them to COVID. They're gone into a different world altogether. I'm getting off topic here. What I really would love to see now, I think now is the time, coming out of this shit, let's just be a little bit more out in front, bit more positive about things. Tell people what's going on. Not telling you should be doing this. I think it's a collective
effort. Happening, Stu, and to be fair to Stephen, he's best placed to see that because he's in the offices.
That's for Stephen's benefit. I'm talking about bringing people forward with you.
I don't see enough of it. I personally don't.
No, but I'm not on social media like you are, you know.
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah, and we've had Will in, obviously looks after the underage setup, and we've had different FEI staff. We've invited Mark on, and I'd love if Mark will come on, Jonathan Hill, whoever. The stage is there for them.
Yeah, I'm sure that they'll have no problem.
Absolutely.
As Stewie said, I think there may be something with what Stewie's saying as well. I do think that what's happening with government, you'd like to know. You'd know, I'd be one of them that would like to know a little bit more about how is that relationship, because it looks like it's good, right?
Yeah.
But what's actually going on? Are we going to get a cut of the tax money around betting? This is the talk that we're hearing, that a slice of that's going to start coming to the game, which is whatever millions comes into us, which we should have been getting anyway, by the way. I still can't get my head around
the horse here.
Yeah, but I say, like, the betting tax, every penny that's put on a horse or a football or anything, goes into horse. None of it's come back to us. Yeah. The money's been
that's a perfect example. Yeah,
so we're hearing that money, the slice of it's going to come to football, and how that money gets utilised and used, it may well be used. Hopefully, you never know what he's going to use it. I'm hearing that might go into, you know, having a full time youth development officer at every single club, which is great. But as Stewie's saying, we maybe like to hear a few sound bites of what is actually going on. But I definitely see a better presence from government at games. I definitely think that they're more in tune, because it's important as well for the League of Ireland support as well to be locked lobbying his local councillors and that's the big drive. You know, when they come to my door, I know my son is the first one out to be telling them about Bowes and about the ground, that we need to get this and we need to get that. And it does need the League of Ireland community to push the local politicians to ensure that that air game, because that's what the GAA are really good at. Yeah. And we're not as good as they are in the halls of power to be pushing. But the guy in the street, the local fan that listens to this, can have an influence. Mm. Everybody has a voice.
Yeah. Paul McAuliffe, that local TD? Yeah. Okay. He was my class.
Yep. Stephen,
I'm going to get him in a headlock.
Absolutely brilliant to come in, tell your story, give us your time, all that. I'm going to give you a little bit of advice. What the doctor told you, tell us what you're doing in the next 40 minutes. Never mind about all that bit.
Do you know the next 40 minutes is to try and get Park and Tag back up because our system went down. So, and just I'll finish on this one because I suppose we're all involved in the game. I was at the game last night and as the game finished, I hung around to the very, very end. And Dave Collins, who is Nathan Collins' dad, came into the ground. He was in the ground. He'd been coaching the team that night. Didn't expect his kid, to play. The emotion, the raw emotion, Stuart Gilhooly would be a good friend of his, and Stuart went down to him. But the raw emotion, I've never seen that. He couldn't even speak because his son has made his debut for him. And that's what playing for Ireland is about. You see Ogbeni's talking about what it means for him to play for Ireland, and that's our passion for our game, and it's just brilliant to see. I think it was lost a bit. I felt it was lost a bit.
Agree.
Do you know
totally
why
agree.
I think it's there a little bit more now? And obviously we're close in terms of Stephen because where he's come from and we know him. But I think with the players, they're so relatable now to us.
Yes,
because they're normal Joes.
Yeah.
Which is they are, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it used to annoy me, Alan, when I'd be in Abbottstown and you'd have all these security blocking the players away from. We should that connection between the supporters. And do you know what I loved last night? And the women do it brilliantly, by the way, at the end of the game. They come down to the side. And I watched Nathan Collins and a couple of your lads go down to the side to see their family, to see their friends. That's what it's about. Like, the connection needs to be between the supporters and the players, and we need to be all as one.
And I think the players want that as well. Absolutely. To be fair to them.
Like, this
crack of shyness away. Nonsense.
Go away.
Like, I saw Daryl Horgan actually after the game. He was waving relentlessly at somebody in the crowd. Like, probably most of me, might be the mum or dad, someone in the family, but obviously he's heading back to England now, and he's actually getting to see someone in the family in the flesh, even if they're only 100 yards away.
And you know what I love about them, right? And I might be a bit biased here because obviously we're League of Ireland and the podcast, and we're at matches and this, that, and the other. And you look at the boys playing last night, and I was sitting beside a lad from Sligo who was doing the commentary with us on Carl Milani, and I just said to Carl, "See these lads, Carl." I says, "They're the best lads in the world." I said, "See Enda Stevens. I played him at St. Pat's." Brief. I says, "He's a dream. He's an absolute dream of a young fella." I said, "See Jamie McGrath. An absolute gentleman of a kid.
I've never met a nicer kid.
Daryl Horgan. They're the nicest young kids." And I'm not just saying this because we're being... They're genuinely the nicest.
Jamie McGrath to walk in with my daughter. That's the guy I want. And I said, to go back to the Collins family, I loved it. And it's what the passion of him, his son making his debut for him, because his family are entrenched in the game. He sent us a message there this morning saying, "Sorry, I couldn't talk to you at the game. I was just that emotional." And it was just it warmed my heart to have to say.
I don't want anyone to get my daughter. If anyone goes out with my daughter, okay, I'll be doing the Will Smith and Martin Lawrence skit from Bad Boys. I'll be the drunk uncle.
Okay, on that note, we'll finish it. Stephen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Good to see you. Thank you as always. That was episode 29. Thanks a million for listening, folks. We will have news on the live show, which is coming up in a month, so keep an eye on our social media channels. We'll be announcing that in a month. Big show. Stewie's even going to sing. He's even going to sing. But we'll talk to you next week. And thanks a million to Benetti Menswear as well. Thank you.
We can do it in the Aviva after one of the Ireland games.
I'm finished the show and you're still talking.
Thank you for listening to Cawley's Call, powered by Benetti Menswear. For more interviews like this, please subscribe to my podcast or follow on all my social media channels.